Support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants. Since 1985, offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Records are already falling at the 2004 Olympics, and the Games are still several months away. The bill for security for the Athens Games has now reached $1.2 billion. The initial estimate was about half that. Early Wednesday morning, in a suburb of Athens, three bombs exploded outside a police station. Philip Hirsch, who writes for the Chicago Tribune and has been covering the Olympic Games for more than 25 years, has just returned from Athens. He joins me now from Chicago. Philip, the Greek authorities are downplaying Wednesday's explosions. What's their rationale for that?
Well, there are two rationales. One, there are quote-unquote anarchist bombings in Greece on a virtually weekly basis. We had a report from one of our sources that there have been 31 of these things this year.
Wow.
This one drew a lot of attention because it occurred exactly 100 days before the Olympic Games. I think that outside of Greece, or maybe in places where terrorism has struck directly, we may be a little more sensitive to this sort of stuff. Clearly, this was an embarrassment for them, occurring 100 days before the Olympics, when there was a lot of attention, negative attention, some would say, on Athens because of the slow preparation pace.
Nevertheless, the U.S. has offered additional help to the Greek security forces. The Australians announced this week that they will have two jets at the ready to evacuate their athletes at the first sign of trouble. This is not exactly sounding like a joyful celebration of faster, higher, stronger, is it?
It's a factor, clearly, of a difficult world. Without question, that's the situation. The United States, I talked to Jim Scheer, who's the acting executive director of the U.S. Olympic Committee, and I asked him if there were an evacuation plan, and he said, we will have one in place, but as far as he understood, there has always been an evacuation in place. If you hold an event of this scope in the post-9/11 world with the situation in Iraq, I don't think you can avoid this kind of talk about security or this kind of incredible emphasis on security. I'm not meaning to downplay this in the slightest, but I just think that it's a factor of the world as much as the Games being in Greece. A lot of people think it's because of Greece's proximity to the Middle East, because of Greece's historically porous borders with the former Soviet satellites of Bulgaria and Albania. I don't know what else you can do. If you're spending $1.2 or $1.4 billion and you've got NATO as a backup, I don't know what else you can do. If you're going to hold the event, they've clearly made a lot of efforts to make the security as good as humanly possible.
Despite what's been going on 100 days before the Olympics, on Thursday, the mayor of Athens urged foreign visitors to come to the Games. Is this because the mayor has some indication that folks with tickets may have begun to change their plans?
I think clearly a couple of things have happened. One was the announcement approximately 2 weeks ago by the International Olympic Committee that they had secured cancellation insurance against natural disaster or earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
They've been working on that cancellation insurance for a long time. Announcing it so close to the Olympics, when people's attention was finally getting on the Olympics, was going to have only one effect, and that was to frighten people away. There's also very, very limited hotel space. The circulation of traffic, if you're not an accredited person or in a taxi, is going to be extremely limited. It's not going to be particularly easy getting back and forth from venue to venue. Even Jacques Rogge, the president of the International Olympic Committee, told me that when I interviewed him in Lausanne in early March. It's not going to be an easy Olympics to be a spectator at.
Well, how easy will it be to be a competitor? Will the runners have a place to run? Will the swimmers have a place to swim? Because, of course, this was a concern even before the security concerns surfaced.
Well, clearly, there is still a lot of work to be done, although a vast percentage of it is what one would call cosmetic work, landscaping and other things. With the exception of the stadium, which is the biggest issue left, I don't have any doubt that the rest of the venues are going to be done enough to compete in. The biggest mess that you see now is the road to Marathon, which I drove on Wednesday of this week, which is 20 kilometers of construction, and it's really quite incredible, the scope of the construction, and obviously the roof over the Olympic Stadium. And the big issue with that roof being moved or not being moved is if they can't move the roof, it's in a position that makes it very difficult to do some of the work that remains to be done in the immediate environs just outside the stadium. Mm-hmm. So they've got to come up with a plan B, because otherwise access to the stadium could be complicated by if that roof structure is still sitting where it's sitting as of this week.
On another front, the U.S. Justice Department announced on Tuesday that it has turned over materials to Senator John McCain's Commerce Committee. These are materials relating to the criminal investigation of Balco Labs and various Olympic athletes. Are we likely to see any athletes removed from the U.S. Olympic team?
Given what the grounds on which one can suspend an athlete for drug use are, I would think that absent an admission from an athlete, there'd be no way to remove them. I certainly would like to defend an athlete whom they try to remove, for instance, for hearsay or secondary evidence or whatever. Absence of positive drug test, or as in the case of Ben Johnson now in 1988 when he went before the Dublin Inquiry in Canada and admitted years of drug use, not just that one positive test from the Seoul Olympics. Absent that, it would be very, very hard to remove people.
Finally, Philip, you've been covering the Olympics for more than 25 years. In that time, has any games been beset with such pre-games worries?
I don't think any previous Olympics has been beset with this many, but let's not forget the mess in Montreal in 1976 when the roof never did get built. Let's not forget that if you arrived in Barcelona a week before the games and stood still for more than 2 minutes, somebody painted you because they were doing everything at the last minute. Let's not forget that even in Sydney there were problems a year out, and yet Sydney wound up being a spectacular Olympic Games. So, yes, it is absolutely true that no previous Olympics had this many problems, but it's also true that many previous Olympics had problems and turned out okay.
Philip Hirsch writes for the Chicago Tribune. Philip, thank you very much for speaking with me.
It's my pleasure as always.
On Thursday, exactly 50 years after the start of the mile race in which Roger Bannister ran the world's first sub-4-minute mile, athletes approached the starting line on the same track, Oxford's Iffley Road, for another mile race. As runners began the final lap, Bannister himself rang the same bell used in 1954, and just as it happened half a century ago, only one runner circled the track four times in less than 4 minutes. As Only a Game's Karen Given reports, athletes in England weren't the only ones this week remembering Bannister's achievement.
The most sought-after target in athletics, the four-minute mile, was achieved yesterday evening on the Oxford University track at Iffley Road.
It might be hard to tell from the understated tone of this BBC newsreel, but when Roger Bannister crossed the finish line in 3 minutes 59.4 seconds on May 6, 1954, his achievement became instant news around the world. Neil Bascom is the author of the new book, The Perfect Mile, Three Athletes, One Goal, and Less Than 4 Minutes to Achieve It.
It was huge news. It transcended track and field. It transcended sport. It became a heralding achievement for humanity in a great way. And it was front page news across the world, and Bannister was held up as saving the empire. It was a magnificent event that brought him a celebrity known by very few.
The 4 minute mile had a romantic symmetry to it, four laps around the track and a minute each. Decades before, scientists had questioned whether the first athlete to achieve that time would die from the strain. But in the mid-40s, athletes came within a second and a half. And in the early 50s, three athletes came close: England's Bannister, Australia's John Landy, and America's Wes Santee. Bannister took an intellectual approach. He recruited two elite runners to help set the perfect pace through the first 3.5 laps, a favor he was quick to acknowledge as he breathlessly spoke with reporters after the race.
I was very lucky to have my two friends, Chris Walsh and Chris Chataway, who helped to make some of the running earlier on, which gave me that extra spur to go on.
We were forbidden by the Amateur Athletic Union to even talk about pacers.
Wes Santee was a student at the University of Kansas and the American mile record holder in 1954.
He ran the time, so we can't take anything away from him. And they approached it much more scientific than we did. We approached it more from a competitive point of view. I think if we had been allowed to bring the American runners together as the British did, there is no reason why we couldn't have likewise done it.
Each of the men trying to break the sub-4-minute mile had their own challenges. Bannister was a medical student with less than an hour a day to train. Landy was running against inferior competition on substandard tracks while dealing with bungling race officials who once failed to stretch the finish tape across the track in time. Longtime sports journalist Frank DeFord says Santee had his college scholarship to think about.
Santee, many people think, was potentially the best athlete. He had an awful lot of bad luck. And at college, he wouldn't be able to prepare for the mile. They would have him run the mile, and then they would have him run the mile relay. I mean, they worked him like a dog in order to get points for the University of Kansas team.
Less than 7 weeks after Bannister broke the barrier, Landy bested his time by a second and a half. Facing sanctions from the amateur establishment and looming ROTC obligations, Santee's best time stayed at 4 minutes, 0.5 seconds. Though America would have to wait for Jim Ryan in 1966 to hold the world record for the mile, DeFord says the country was not disappointed.
This was a human quest. Yes, the British were proud that their man was the one who did it, but everybody on the face of the earth was just thrilled. I mean, in the same way that when Neil Armstrong first walked on the moon, I mean, we could be the proudest, but it was an accomplishment for humankind and not for any one nation.
Though he'll never break the barrier, 72-year-old Santee says he has no plans to stop running.
I run now 2 or 3 times a week just for fun, and I did run a master's race, I think, in 1977, and I ran a 2:05 half mile. But afterwards, I decided I really didn't have anything to prove, so I just run for fun now. If I run a while and I get tired, I stop and walk and enjoy the sunshine.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. Crazy Legs Conti, a premier performer in competitive eating events, has challenged the world's best and fastest consumers of oysters, hot dogs, pancakes, even string beans. But on Tuesday night, the popcorn sarcophagus proved to be more than even the normally voracious Conti could consume. Faced with eating his way out of a 60-cubic-foot popcorn box in which he'd been buried, Conti cried uncle after powering down approximately 8 cubic feet to snack. Failed stunt, which was staged as a promotion for the opening of a film, did not discourage Conti. Evel Knievel had Snake Canyon. I have popcorn sarcophagus, he said. I will try again and again until I overcome the challenge. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, the penny drives and hunger strikes, which supporters of school sports hope will keep American kids on the courts, rinks, tracks, and fields. But first, the NHL's quality quartet is set to quarrel over the league's quintessential quarry. But will the quixotic cup quest be overshadowed by the league's questionable quandary? Here to answer that queer query is Helene Elliott, the L.A. Times sudden death scribe and Only a Game sultaness of the stick save. Welcome back, Helene.
Hi there.
Helene, let's start with the Eastern Conference Finals, which begin today when the Tampa Bay Lightning host the Philadelphia Flyers. The Lightning were the league's second best regular season team this year, so it is safe to say, I assume, they're not just happy to be there.
That is true, and it's also safe to say, as coaches love to tell their players, you can throw out everything from the regular season, which leads us to the question of why did we bother going through 82 games?
Where have I heard that before?
But it was interesting because Tampa Bay did sweep the season series from Philadelphia, but they're both a little bit different teams now, particularly Philadelphia. The Flyers have gone through an amazing season in terms of injuries, and this is a team that's always been built on muscle. I think Bob Clark, or as he was known then, Bobby Clark, from the leftover days of his Broad Street Bullies Flyers teams always thought that you had to have muscle to win in the NHL and goons. And at this late date, he's come to realize that you really do need some finesse in the league these days. And he has a very interesting team there with Zhamnov and Amonte and Roenick, and a pretty balanced team, much different than some of the Flyer teams we've seen in the past. And there's some really good attitude there, some really good chemistry there. I really like the way they're playing.
The Flyers won the Cup back in 74 and again in 75. Those were, of course, the Broad Street Bully teams. Do you feel as if they are reasserting themselves as a hockey power in this new manifestation?
Yeah, and again, it's really interesting how they've done it and how it's always been a problem there the last few years has been the goaltending. And Clark is an interesting character in that, you know, most teams build from the goaltender on out. And he has said that he builds from the forwards on back. And, you know, it's one of these hockey axioms that, you know, goaltending is everything. And he's one of the few people who hasn't built his teams that way, yet they've gotten as far as they have. And Robert Esch, their goaltender, has played very well. You know, they also went out and got Sean Burke during the season as insurance because they weren't sure if Robert Esch would be up to the test of playing every day and playing in the playoffs. And Esch has been terrific.
Tomorrow, the Calgary Flames will take on the San Jose Sharks, who will enjoy home ice advantage for that series. What have San Jose fans done to deserve this that fans in Montreal, Boston, Toronto, places like that haven't?
It's really kind of funny because this is the season that everybody was expecting from the San Jose Sharks last year. A lot of people, a lot of quote-unquote experts, and I won't put my name among them, but picked the Sharks to actually win the Cup last year, or at least go to the Western Finals last year, and their season got derailed because Nabokov, their goaltender, held out. There was a contract dispute, so he got started late, and there were a couple of other things that went wrong in terms of injuries and a few things that just didn't happen right. They end up firing their general manager, firing their coach. They had a terrible season. They missed the playoffs, and then here they are bouncing back with a great season now, and it's a year later, but they've been a terrific story. They've been fun to watch. You know, it's so funny because people from the East Coast will call me and say, wow, the Sharks, they're a real surprise. And I'll say, well, I guess you haven't been watching them all season, have you? You should be staying up late more.
The Calgary Flames won their first and only Stanley Cup in 1989. Would a win this year help preclude a future move to Mexico City or the island of Elba or wherever?
Elba, that'd be a nice road trip.
Long road trip.
You know, financially, it's been a huge help to them to go as far as they've gone. You know, you look at their crowds, and it's almost like they don't let anybody in the building who isn't wearing head-to-toe Calgary Flames merchandise, and that helps them as well. You know, plus a city like that, it's not a huge city, and it's big enough to still have the kind of idea of civic pride, and people there are just so behind the hockey team that it's really nice to see. And they are the last Canadian team standing, believe it or not. So even people in Edmonton are rallying behind them to a degree, you know, Edmonton being their sworn rival. But all of Canada has kind of adopted them as this gritty little team that's gone a lot further than anybody thought they would.
Absent from the third round this year are usual suspects, Detroit, Toronto, Colorado, Dallas. Do you consider this a refreshing change?
Absolutely. I'm just so tired of going to Detroit and hearing all the hockey town stuff, and I know I'll get nasty letters and phone calls from people, but it does help other teams when you give them the sense that they have a chance and you don't just go into a season thinking, ah, Detroit's going to win the Cup or Colorado's going to win the Cup. The final four teams started the season with payrolls that were ranked number three, who were the Flyers, and the other three were 19, 20, and 21 in payroll. So at least it gives other teams the sense that they can compete with the big boys.
Which, if any, of the four contending teams we've discussed are league officials secretly hoping will meet in the Stanley Cup Finals?
I would say league officials would love to see the Flyers in there. You know, it's the biggest market left, and it's a traditional team. It's, you know, one of the original 12.
I love that. It's opposed to the original six, which weren't really the original
and
six anyway.
And
then
you have the original 26, but that's another story, too. But I think they'd like to see Philadelphia. As for the other side, I think, you know, San Jose would be a great story, and it would be a huge help to hockey there. But, you know, there's a number of people who would still like to see a Canadian team in the finals, which hasn't happened for a while. So, you know, there's a contingent that would be rooting for Calgary.
Helene Elliott is the Los Angeles Times hockey homer and Only a Game's Helen of the Handshake Line, not to be confused with Troy. Thanks again, Helene.
Thank you.
When your defensemen, they are defenseless, your team is unprotected. And the crowd, they grow restless, they basically expect it.
What do they expect?
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. At Tsongas Arena in Lowell, Massachusetts, on March 1st, the high school hockey team from Winthrop, Massachusetts, and its fans sometimes didn't know whether to celebrate or grieve. The playoff game against Peabody High School was going Winthrop's way. The goal by Paul Arruzzioni, son of 1980 Olympics hero Mike Arruzzioni, put Winthrop up by two. But just before the postseason began, the Winthrop players had been told that because the town's populace had failed to vote to raise taxes earmarked for the schools, the hockey team, as well as the high school's other sports programs, might be abolished. Even as he delighted in the hockey team's performance, Winthrop High Athletic Director Pete Gobiel worried that some of the students on the ice and in the stands might drop out of school if the high school experience didn't include sports.
It is no great secret to anybody in education that we keep kids in school. Students' grades go up during their sports seasons. I mean, you know, you hate to say it, we've all been there, but there isn't a rush by a lot of kids to wake up and run to math class, you know, but they do get there early so that they're not in trouble from their coach about being at practice.
Shortly after Winthrop had beaten Peabody to advance to the next round of the playoffs, I asked Winthrop player Matt Driscoll whether he and his teammates had felt especially motivated, given that hockey might not survive the decision of the folks who'd voted against the tax increase.
We hung up a big thing in the rink to show, like, that this could be our last year. So it's a real big, I think it helped us, actually. Because, I mean, it's not like we're playing for, like, the whole town anymore. We're playing for our supporters and ourselves now because, I mean, people do that to you. It's kind of crummy.
In the struggle to maintain extracurricular programs, Winthrop has had lots of company. In school districts across the country, parents, school administrators, and politicians have debated various ways to pay for programs they suddenly can't take for granted.
All those in favor, please raise your right hand. All opposed. Motion carries 6-0.
John Fuller, the president of the school board of the Blue Valley School District in Kansas City, Missouri, recently presided over the establishment of an activity fees program. Fuller favors that approach over a pay-for-play fee that would be paid only by the parents of the students participating in particular sports or activities.
The challenge that we found was that when we talked about doing a pay-for-participation or pay-for-play, was that the money that we generated was substantial. But we could actually generate more money and charge less money per student if we charged every student a programming fee. I consider it real similar to a collegiate program where they charge a student activities fee. And as such, the pain is less per household, but every household pays it.
According to John Fuller, the problem with an activities fee approach is the folks whose kids aren't playing hockey, starring in the spring musical, or leading the debate team to the state tournament sometimes object to paying even a small fee. The school board of the Blue Valley District has addressed that difficulty with a rebate program.
Yeah, and that's pretty unique. I do a lot of work with school districts around the country, and I have not heard of a district that offers you a refund if you choose not to participate. And in this case, most of our kids, about 85% of our kids, participate in some form of extracurricular or co-curricular activity, and as such, only a small percentage will be eligible for the refund. But you can ask for your money back, and it will be refunded.
In Minnesota's Anoka-Hennepin School District, a pay-for-play scheme has been in effect for over a decade. Until recently, the fee of about $60 per student per activity did not seem to discourage anybody from trying out for anything. But over the past 4 years, successive budget crunches have forced school officials to increase the fees. Boys and girls who make the basketball teams now pay $332 to play, up $224 from just 2 years ago. Eric Latola, the activities director at Chaplain Park High School outside Minneapolis, says the increase in fees has changed the composition of the teams.
Take a sport like basketball we've been talking about, where we're pretty much going to have about 60 to 65 kids in the program in any given year. But from year to year, the prices may have increased, but the number stays the same. But you don't see those marginal kids in the middle that can't afford to come out because of the fees. I would say every year, just a ballpark figure in my mind, maybe 30 to 50 kids that choose not to be a part of extracurricular activities because finances are too great an obstacle.
Cognizant that even the increasing fees don't cover the expenses of most sports and other pursuits, Eric Latola and other administrators in similar positions have been exploring additional ways to fund their programs.
The tighter the belts have to get, the tougher it makes everything. A great part of the responsibility of the coaches these days is to raise money, to do fundraising. They're in the town practicing their marketing and their salesmanship.
In some areas, the fragile state of school services and extracurricular opportunities, sports included, has turned children into activists. When the West Contra Costa County, California School District's budget shortfall of $16.5 million became apparent, Zoe Oppenheim, a 10-year-old elementary school student in a neighboring district, started a penny drive.
We were listening to a talk show in the morning, and a guy was just being kind of not very nice about the situation, and it made my sister, my dad, and I really kind of upset, and we heard about a penny drive that happened in New York a couple of years ago. We thought maybe we could try one here.
Zoe Oppenheim has already presented West Contra Costa County School Superintendent Gloria Johnson with a check for over $2,300, and the coins are still rolling in, though Zoe's father, Don Oppenheim, is dubious about whether this sort of fundraising can save school libraries, let alone sports and activities programs.
This kind of campaign, it has 1 year sustainability at most, so you can't count on it every single year. Programs are still very threatened across California, maybe nationally, I don't know. One thing I do know is my high school age girl, Emily, plays basketball on her team, and before the season ended, I had given over $300 for her to be able to participate.
And they have to sell chocolate bars and stuff so they can get to play.
Some of the students who attend schools in the West Contra Costa County School District have also been trying to publicize the impending loss of their libraries, school counselors, and sports programs. They've staged a mock funeral for the services and activities they've lost, and some members of the community are planning a hunger strike. Cesar Cruz, who worked as a Healthy Start coordinator in the district for 5.5 years before budget cuts eliminated his job, recently led a group of students on a march to the state capitol.
It took us 8 days, our entire spring break. You can imagine young people during the spring break, they want to go on vacation, they want to go to the beach, they want to do other things. They sacrificed their spring break. We had 50 students that marched the entire length of 70 miles. And when they arrived in Sacramento, Governor Schwarzenegger was there. He was there to meet with other students to shake their hands for a photo op, but he couldn't sit down 15 minutes with our kids who had marched 15 miles because they needed to address him about serious issues of losing their counselors, their sports, their libraries. That to us was tragic.
It seems likely that public schools that are not adequately funded, a great many public schools, will continue to depend on pay-for-play plans and activities fees, not to mention door-to-door fundraising campaigns, car washes, bake sales, coin drives, and marches. The alternative would be to eliminate the programs, sports among them, that are taxing school budgets. Bob Canaby, the executive director of the National Federation of High School Associations, contends it would be a mistake to do that.
I think we have to look at these opportunities for the reasons why they were originally placed in our schools. America is the only nation in the world that has an education-based athletic and activity program. You don't find it in any other place. The reason for it is simple. There are just some things that cannot be duplicated in the classroom that are more easily duplicated in the field of competition against other young people in the area of sports, or the experiences that one raises or enjoys by being on a stage or in a band or orchestra, things of that nature. The danger for us basically is if we give short shrift to these kinds of things, then what we are saying is that we don't see this educational value any longer.
In some communities where superintendents, school boards, and voters have been faced with weighing the educational value of sports against the cost of putting teams on the field, for athletes whose families can't afford the user fees, the outcome Bob Canaby fears has already come to pass. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Hotel Commonwealth Boston, located in the Fenway Park neighborhood, near historic mansions, universities, medical institutions, and cultural sites. Information at hotelcommonwealth.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the lighter side of the Black Prince of Baseball. But first, our look at the week's news with Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
The San Antonio Spurs, up 2-0, have either humbled the Lakers or given L.A. an opportunity to prove themselves in that NBA second-round playoff series. Which is it?
I think that they've humbled the Lakers, and I don't think the Lakers can beat the Spurs in the series anymore. I felt completely differently prior to the opening of this one. But the Lakers look old, they look slow, they look apathetic, and the Spurs look like they're very much interested in defending their championship. They've just made the Lakers look like an over-the-hill basketball team.
Dwayne Wade's 22 points withstanding the Indiana Pacers. I knew I wouldn't get through that sentence.
Unfortunately, he couldn't carry them along.
Point. Anyway, he scored 22 points. The Pacers easily dispatched the Miami Heat in Game 1 of their second-round series. The Pacers romp here on
Yeah, I think Miami will get one win for the home folks, and they've had a nice run. And if they do anything in the free agent market next year, they're going to be a really, really good team. I think this one ends in 5.
Kevin Garnett of the Minnesota Timberwolves was the overwhelming choice for the NBA's most valuable player, but he couldn't get the Wolves past Sacramento in Game 1 of that series. Does he rise to the occasion from here on?
Well, he's gotten the one playoff series win under his belt that he needed. I don't think there's any question he was the most valuable player in the league this year. He is the most versatile, the most talented, and now that he's got at least one black mark off his record as regards postseason play, I think that the Timberwolves have been surprised that Sacramento is as good as they are.
Very shortly after Dale Earnhardt was killed in the crash at the Daytona 500 several years ago, a charitable fund was begun in his name. The news this week is that the folks administering that fund haven't given away much of the $3 million that they've collected. They are, they say, being careful and selective. Do we buy this?
Let's buy it temporarily and say they're being too careful and too selective. They sent $41,000 to Ducks Unlimited and $20,000 each to Salvation Army and Feed the Children. There's also been a gift of $25,000 to a forest reclamation project. I think Daniel Borachev, who's from the American Institute of Philanthropy, is right. When you send your money to a charity, you expect it's going to be spent within a year or two and not three.
Right.
I mean, I know it's sitting in a bank account accruing interest and so forth, but pretty soon you have, you know, the purpose of charitable money is to, like, do charity.
And you worry a little bit that the people not giving the money away are perpetrating their own jobs as regards the fund.
That's right.
I'm sure it's great fun to be in the semifinals of the Stanley Cup chase. On the other hand, some of the players on teams that didn't make it that far have been having a fine time in Prague at the World Ice Hockey Championships,
Especially the players from the United States of America who went over to Prague and beat the home squad. The tournament's wide open. The United States may wind up being the World Hockey Championship. And will people notice?
Who'd
of course not.
It? Charlie, we have talked at times about the curious case of the Milwaukee Brewers. The family of Commissioner Bud Selig still owns a majority interest in the team, which, though not winning on the ball field as usual, is apparently doing pretty well at the gate these days.
Yes, guess what? They have a $27.5 million payroll, and their revenue is $115.9 million.
Well, that would be more,
now,
wouldn't it?
Now, you don't have to be Stephen Hawking to figure out this is pretty good math. Once again, the current ownership of the Brewers, which may or may not include Bud Selig, but probably does, it promised that they would plow the money from the new stadium back into the ball club as part of the deal for to get public money to build the stadium. If baseball had a real commissioner, he'd probably be looking into this, but apparently it's going to be left to the Wisconsin State Legislature.
By the way, Commissioner Bud announced that the Oakland A's need a new stadium, too. So I guess we can
well,
start
look how well it works.
That's great.
All you have to do is lie and build a stadium and rake in the dough.
On the field, what story compares to Roger Clemens of the Astros? He's won six games. Does this suggest that every pitcher's best career move might be to retire and then unretire, kind of like boxers have been doing for years?
Well, I mean, he goes on and on. He's, you know, he's been a genuine phenomenon for a while. The Houston Astros are using him just right. He's only pitched 38 innings in his six starts. He can give them, you know, six or seven real blowout best he's got innings, and then they bring in the bullpen. He could wind up 19-2 or something this year.
And another Cy Young Award.
He certainly
he's on, I think he's on the track.
The interesting thing is if the season ended today, like if Bud Selig was to go to jail in Wisconsin, your Cy Young Award winners could conceivably be Roger Clemens, who's 41, and Kevin Brown, who's 39.
Under pressure from people with nothing better to be outraged about, Major League Baseball has decided not to put ads for the movie Spider-Man 2 on the bases during the weekend the movie is opening. A victory for the integrity of the national pastime?
I'm glad to hear you mock this, because I was really worried about that. I thought we'd really have a dispute given your love for the national pastime.
No.
Again, if baseball had a real commissioner and or if Bud Selig was in, oh, I don't know, jail, this probably wouldn't have been an issue. It was not an issue to me. I don't care. I mean, I enjoyed Charlie Finley back in the day when he painted the bases orange or green or whatever it was he
did. There you go.
First of all, I don't understand quite the promotion. If you were watching a game on TV, would you know that was the Spider-Man logo, or would you just figure it was a clump of, like, dust, dirt from the
infield?
That's
why they have zoom lenses, I
guess.
You can help me out with another part of this story, Charlie. Is there any truth to the rumor that the logos on the bases had to go because cast members in Spider-Man 2 balked at wearing Major League Baseball jerseys?
I have absolutely no idea. I do think that having, you know, Spider-Man defeat the villain Steinbrenner in the new issue is going a little bit too far.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and, of course, joins me each week at this time to spin sports tales, which you can also hear on the web if you go to onlyagame.org. Thank you, Charlie.
I got to get me one of them baseball games.
There's more information about this week's stories on our website, onlyagame.org, where you can also read the latest sports news, browse the Only a Game store, or get in touch with us. If Hal Chase was not the most exceptional first baseman ever to grace a baseball diamond, he was, as they say, among them. But Chase, whose major league career extended from 1905 until 1919, has gone down in baseball's annals not as a graceful fielder and dangerous hitter, but as a guy willing to boot enough ground balls to lose a game if anybody asked and the money was right. In The Black Prince of Baseball, Hal Chase and the Mythology of the Game, Donald Dewey and Nicholas Acucella have presented the story of Hal Chase's life and his career. The authors join me now from NPR's Bureau in New York City. Don Dewey and Nick Acucella, welcome to Only a Game. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Bill.
I want to make the point right away that The Black Prince of Baseball is an ambitious and thorough biography, 417 pages of same. Don Dewey, was it your feeling that Hal Chase had gotten a raw deal from history that led you guys to undertake this really ambitious project?
Very much so. I think our starting point was the fact that every institution, like baseball, has a mythology. And Chase always played the role of Lucifer. Mathewson, McGraw, Cobb, they were the archangels. And Chase was always the bad guy. He was the one who was really responsible for everything. And as we went into the book, we found, as we had already suspected, that this was hardly the case, that in fact there were far more noted names, including many in Cooperstown, who had their fingers caught in the cookie jar a lot more frequently than Chase.
In fact, because Chase was flamboyant and involved in some unsavory things, nowhere near as many as he's been charged with, but involved in some, they used him as a scapegoat for just about everything that went wrong in baseball in the teens.
Including the Black Sox scandal.
Including the Black Sox, which is the most intriguing part of this, that he's blamed for actually orchestrating the Black Sox scandal, which couldn't possibly have been true because he was on a barnstorming tour with the Giants in New England and Canada when the plot was hatched.
Right.
In fact, we have a newspaper account from a Vermont newspaper showing that while he was supposed to be hatching the Black Sox plot in New York, he was actually throwing a game in Vermont against a Negro League team.
I couldn't have done that, Judge. I was committing a crime somewhere
exactly.
else.
I didn't do the murder. I was doing a robbery somewhere else.
Nick, Bill James is among the baseball historians whom you cite as blaming most of the criminal acts that have occurred within baseball on Hal Chase. Why did that happen if, as you maintain, Chase was perhaps only the most charming of the rascals of those baseball days?
James's screed is inexplicable because it's so far after the fact. The only thing I can assume is that he swallowed the mythology whole.
What really bothered a lot of people then and now, obviously in the case of Bill James, is the fact that Chase was a superb player.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody from Babe Ruth to Ty Cobb, when making up their dream teams, Chase was their first baseman. So that this guy was truly Lucifer. He was not just some small-time crook. He was disturbing the entire mythology of the game.
There's a third element, too, that may have carried down through the years. Chase was deliciously irreverent about baseball. Baseball was the way he made money.
Mm-hmm.
And if you could make more money by betting on the other team than you were making from your salary, why you went ahead and did that.
I think actually one of the interesting things that we found out when we were doing research for the book was there probably has not been another figure in baseball history who was so exclusively dependent on baseball. He would play from March to September. At the end of the regular major league season, he then went back to California. He played, whether it was in the California State League, the Pacific Coast League, and then also played for colleges.
Yeah.
He played for Santa Clara.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He played for St. Mary's.
Other stars of the era had outside investments. Chase wasn't interested in anything except baseball, women, alcohol, and gambling.
Well, that's pretty
cool
place.
That's not a bad combination. That's not a bad combination.
This was Renaissance Man.
He was Renaissance Man. Thank you, Don. That's very good.
All right, guys, you're going to have to let me in here somewhere because it's my show. So I get to ask a question every once in a while. All right, I want to get back to the baseball part of this a little bit because you found a lot of evidence, as you've mentioned, that Chase was a truly gifted player. I gather one of the things he particularly liked to do at first base, he'd field a bunt, tag out the batter, then turn and throw out the guy going from first to second.
Mm-hmm. Charge a bunt and throw with runners on first and second and throw to third.
Yeah, in baseball terms, he was, let's say, the prototype of a Keith Hernandez.
Yeah.
Well, why wasn't that enough? I mean, he was a great player. He would have been in the Hall of Fame if all of this kind of mud hadn't covered part of his reputation, probably. Why wasn't it enough to be known as the greatest first baseman who had ever played the game?
This was a guy who played poker until 5 o'clock in the morning every night. I mean, this was a guy who constantly had debts.
And the money he didn't gamble away, he threw across the bar. And the
exactly.
rest of it he wasted on chorus girls.
Yeah. I mean, this was not somebody for whom a salary, no matter how high it was, in fact, it was one of the higher salaries of
yes.
the day, He would never have enough money.
He would forge his contract to show a lower figure than what it actually was, and the forged contract is what he would show to his wife. So he always had pin money for the chorus girls, the booze, and the gambling.
Getting the picture, Bill?
I think I'm beginning to understand.
he was your basic ne'er-do-well uncle.
Well, I did read the book, guys, so I was aware of
that.
Oh,
my God, you're the one.
Now, when he was playing in some of these outlaw leagues out in the Southwest, I gather some of his teammates and some of his opponents were the Black Sox, and he held his own against those guys, too, even though he was well beyond his prime.
He played well into his late 40s, mm-hmm. and obviously, little by little, his talent started deserting him, but he could still play. Most of all, there was that desire and that need, that craving need, because he really didn't know how to do anything else.
And the only thing that took him out of the game was an automobile accident.
Yeah.
I mean, where he hurt both his legs in an automobile accident driving from one desert town to another for one of these Arizona games. Otherwise, he'd probably still be playing.
I love that idea.
He probably wouldn't be too good.
But
Willie Mays was quoted the other day. Somebody said to him, Willie, how much would you be making if you were playing today? And he said about $45,000. And they said, what are you talking about? And he said, well, I'm 72 years old.
70, right. Exactly.
Don, Hal Chase, as you have mentioned or alluded to, nearly killed himself with alcohol when he was still a relatively young man, but he managed to find sobriety. He lived into his 60s, and you quote him in his later years as saying that he really wished he'd been elected to the Hall of Fame. Did he express other regrets at that point?
He never actually came right out and said even that he threw games. He kind of like made this kind of generic thing like, I take responsibility. Isn't that the cant of today?
He sounds like a politician.
I take responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Hal Chase was never outlawed from the major leagues.
Right.
A lot of people assume he was because of his involvement in the Black Sox scandal, but he never was. But in terms of his end, and I think this is also, to go back to your original question about Bill James, there's a wonderful melodramatic morality play in this for a lot of people. You know, here's a guy who cheated, who threw away his talents, and he ends up as a drunk who dies, you know? And this satisfies a lot of moralisms on a lot of people's part. What we have instead, though, as the book, I think, makes clear, is that he may have cheated here and there, and he did throw games here and there. But once again, the cheaters around him, the sanctimoniousness and the hypocrisy of the McGraws and the Heidlers and the Johnsons around him was far more structured than his own improvised thrown game here or thrown game there. If there was one specific person who was associated with more scandals and more suspicions of games, seasons, and World Series being thrown between 1903 and the 1930s, it was John McGraw. But, of course, we forget all that now because nobody wants to remember it.
Because he's in the Hall of Fame and he's an icon.
Right. So the next book is John McGraw, Archvillain, right?
What kind of an advance can you give us?
I'll promise to read it. I'll be the only one again.
There you go.
That's right.
A book that should be written, though, Bill.
Don Dewey and Nick Acacella are the authors of The Black Prince of Baseball, Hal Chase and the Mythology of the Game, published by Sport Classic Books. Don, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill. Thanks a million.
Nick, it's been a great pleasure.
And thank you, sir.
Oh, it's been a great pleasure to talk to him, but not to me.
Well, he thanked you, but I'm the pleasure.
I see.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Ferrati. Special thanks this week to Greg Eklund and to Mary Stuckey at Minnesota Public Radio. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear any part of this program again, sign up for our newsletter, or learn more about Hal Chase, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Donald Dewey, co-author of The Black Prince of Baseball, Hal Chase and the Mythology of the Game.
Oh, God, he's a radio professional.
Dewey is currently working on his next book, The Gray Guy of Public Radio Sports, Bill Littlefield and the Myth of Professionalism. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.